Welcome to Historically St. Pete, a weekly conversation where we explore the truths and sometimes the myths of the people and events that created the Sunshine City. My name is Rudy Farias, and every week I get to say this, I have the best job in town. I'm the executive director of the St. Petersburg Museum of History. Located on the St. Pete Pier, the Museum of History has been sharing the stories of the Sunshine City for 102 years now, and we're honored to share those stories with you here on Radio St. Pete. So in late 1800s, the art of designing cities began to include green space, mostly in the form of city parks. The idea of introducing nature to growing commercial and residential neighborhoods was taken hold, even in West Florida and here in what is now St. Pete. When the village that was to become the city of St. Petersburg was platted in 1888, it included a public park, first identified as City Park. Our guest today is Dr. Will Michaels. Will is a historian, celebrated author, a member of various historic boards throughout the city, and my predecessor, the former director of the Museum of History. Welcome, Will.
Good to be here.
Awesome. So in 1893, right, the block between 1st and 2nd Avenue North and 3rd and 4th Streets was set aside as City Park. That was set aside as City Park, right? Was nothing more than an overgrown area with palmetto, wild pigs, a few cows wandering through it, right? It wasn't much of a park at all. That is until the Women of St. Pete formed the Park Improvement Association. So, Will, how important was the involvement of the women's organization?
Well, let me just give you a comment about the frontier state of the park in the beginning there. Yes, there were cows there. There are reports from some of the early settlers, very rare reports because we don't have that much in the way of information, but deers used to be shot there in Williams Park. Boars used to be shot there.
Oh, gosh.
And our famous newspaper editor here, William Lincoln Straub, commented that, quote, the park was an untrimmed jungle and convenient hiding place for truant boys and cows. How do you like that?
Wow. I think I was one of those truant boys back in my childhood when I roamed downtown.
So, the women of the city were really key. I mean, they were the thrust, I would say, of organizing the park and eliminating the jungle there, making it into more of a garden, and adding some of the amenities that that you've mentioned there.
So I heard that they, I mean, not only planned it, they actually did a lot of the physical work as well, and you know, to oversee
they,
it.
They rolled up their sleeves and they pulled weeds. And they planted plants and hedges and trees and did a fantastic job there. It started out in 1893 with what was called the Park Improvement Association. After that, the Women's Town Improvement Association, the famous Women's Town Improvement Association, I think you have a exhibit called Meddling,
the women who built St. Pete.
Yes.
They're a big part of that.
Meddlers are visionaries. And one of the members of the Women's Town Improvement Association at that time was Sarah Williams, the wife of John C. Williams, one of the co-founders of the city. Actually, both he and his wife and Peter Demenz were the three co-founders of the city of St. Petersburg. And it was Williams and Demenz who set aside the block, and their intention was that it would be used for parkland, even though it wasn't officially designated a city park until a few years later. Also, some folks think that John C. Williams named the park after himself, which is not true. That's a myth. And it was actually named after he passed away.
Well, like you said, the Park Improvement Association becomes kind of transforms into the Women's Town Improvement Association, right?
Right.
So it appears that they first start talking about it. We're very fortunate at the museum and archives that we have a lot of their minutes from their meetings. And it appears that they start talking about naming it Williams Park in 1907. But it looks like it wasn't until 1908 until we actually saw something where it's actually called Williams Park. Why do you think it was important to that group that the park be named after Williams?
Well, he was a co-founder of the city. He was the one who made the deal with Peter Demenz to bring the railroad to what's now St. Petersburg rather than what's now Gulfport. He was involved in the deal with Diston, Hamilton Diston, to bring the railroad from the central part of the state all the way over to the Pinellas Peninsula. And he and Diston had a little bit of a falling out there. Demenz got real ambitious and wanted to take it not just to Gulfport, but to take it all the way down to what's now Fort DeSoto. And at that point, Diston blocked and didn't want to provide him with the additional compensation that he was asking for. So he went east and negotiated with Williams, who had a large farm here in the St. Petersburg area, was growing pineapples and other crops here. And lo and behold, a deal was made, and they brought the railroad here rather than to Gulfport. And that made all the difference in the world.
So about that time when they were looking at changing the name, Sarah Williams is now Sarah Williams Armistead. Do you think that she had a role in the park being named after her former husband?
Oh, I think so. I'm sure that, you know, she, you know, my thinking is, and this is just speculation, I think that she was a reserved person, and it was perhaps others. William Straub's wife was a member of the Women's Town Improvement Association. And I wouldn't be surprised if William Straub and his wife, who was also named Sarah, got together and said, wouldn't it be appropriate to name this in honor of John C. Williams, the founder, co-founder of the city?
Makes sense. So tell us, like, some of the key features of the park in the early days. I mean, what were some of the, when you walked into the park actual after the cows had left, right? What could you expect as you walked through the park?
Well, the major key feature was the first bandstand there that was built in 1895, and that was later moved to Waterfront Park. And there's a replica of that at Heritage Village in the Largo area. And that was certainly probably the iconic piece there, which has a great future story. But there were other items there. One was a fountain, a water fountain that was there. The water fountain that's there today is an echo of what was originally there. If you compare the pictures of the original fountain with the one that is in the park presently, they look very, very similar.
Now, did that original, the original bandstand, was it damaged in the hurricane?
It was, but that was after it was moved to Waterfront Park.
Right.
So
okay.
It was moved to Waterfront Park, and then another bandstand was built. And to just carry the story of the bandstands forward here, that bandstand was eventually replaced by the current bandstand, which was built by William Harbert in 1953, a very amazingly modern structure for the early 1950s. You talk about mid-century modern architecture. That was about as modern as you could get back in 1953, and is still an amazing, amazing structure. I mean, it's eye-catching the way it's built with the shaded glass to protect those who are on the stage there from the sun and rain when it does, when we do have bad weather. It's just a really amazing structure. And that actually, along with the entire park, should be designated a city landmark. I don't understand why Williams Park and the bandstand in particular have, for all these years, you know, we've got not as many landmarks as we would like, but a lot of landmarks, and the park and the bandstand is not one of them. So there's a challenge for somebody to pick up.
It's actually shocking that it's not. I mean, I know the city's been, you know, giving some loving to the actual structure, the bandstand structure, over the last couple of years, and there's talk about major renovation to it, to keep that Bill Harvard original look. I'm shocked, actually, that this is the park named after one of the founders of the city that's not designated a historical landmark in St. Pete.
William Straub, of course, went on to design the inverted pyramid structure at the pier, at the pier head there in the early 1970s. And he is really, in my judgment, he is the foremost architect of the city. So his association with the park and that bandstand is also an important reason for designating it as a city landmark.
So park is clean. Beautiful plants, flowers, trees. We have an amazing bandstand, a beautiful, fountain that we've seen, and we have postcards of course. It's just an amazing fountain in the middle of the park. Does it become the focal center for the city? I mean, does it become that place where people gather, socialize, other than just to listen to music?
Well, it does. The music was a big part of it. In 1917, a group called the Royal Scotch Highlanders performed there and did so for many, many years, and they attracted huge crowds of people to enjoy the music and the ambience of the park itself there. So that was a major attraction. In 1912, the Sunshine Pleasure Club started offering various kinds of recreation within the park. They had barnyard golf, otherwise known as horseshoes, croquet, all kinds of table games. You can see, you get the old postcards, and you can see guys playing checkers. And they're all dressed up, too. They've got their
suit and ties.
Their New York and their Chicago suits and ties on, as are the women in their huge flowing dresses. And they're all sitting down playing checkers and chess, of all things. Follow through on that story, eventually that ticked off the Williams family that continued to live here in the city. They had a hotel that they operated for many years. And in 1922, the Williams family actually took the city and Sunshine Pleasure Club to court and got an injunction against Pleasure Club from having all the games and recreation. They thought it was just overpowering the park with all this activity. They wanted a more serene park, and they actually won in the courts there, and that was really the beginnings of the recreational center that we have today at the Sunshine Center with the shuffleboard, and there's a chess club there. The chess players got moved over there as well.
I said lawn bowling, checkers. Yeah, because all that opens around 1924, so that's the timing of everything being moved out to the west side of St. Petersburg at Fifth Street, right? So the band shells, you talked a little bit about the band shells. I mean, I remember, growing up in downtown St. Pete, the Festival Estates concerts that used to happen there, everything from high school bands to symphony orchestras to even, in the late 60s throughout the 70s, some rock and roll nights would be there. So it was a pretty important, and you said serene, but I mean, I remember the park used to be filled with benches, and it became a pretty important musical facility.
For sure. Yeah, it was a cultural center of the city, certainly in terms of music and entertainment. But then beyond that, it became a kind of center for speaking out on the issues of the city, the issues of the state, and the issues of the country. The city began to use it as a site to recognize various luminaries, either living in the city or visiting the city. One was Buster Keaton. Buster Keaton was involved in a film production out at Whedon Island, and he received the key to the city in the park on one occasion. Back in the 1920s, Billy Sunday, a famous evangelist, preached there, spoke there. And John Philip Sousa was one of the conductors of the orchestra there. Can you imagine attending a concert where John Philip Sousa is the conductor? I mean, gee,
no,
that,
I can't.
It doesn't get any more iconic
no, it does
and historic
not. It does
than,
not.
Than that. But then we had local groups who provided entertainment as well. One was the African-American Davis Academy, the children of the academy, sang there and provided musical entertainment for the city as well.
And there were, and you mentioned, you know, you briefly mentioned that it did, the tide turned and along with music became other issues. I remember there being, during the Vietnam War, there being anti-war gatherings there. And I remember, you know, presidential candidates, even before Florida really mattered in elections, came and spoke at Williams Park. So it remained a focal point of the city for
years.
Yeah,
it became a, you know, at the end of World War I, there was a celebration at the park to celebrate the ending of the war, and reportedly over 4,000 people turned out for that celebration. It's hard to imagine today 4,000 people Williams Park. But on the other hand, one of the more bizarre things was that in 1930, the city had a new water system that was developed, so they had a big celebration to celebrate the new water system down at the park, and according to the newspaper, something like 10,000 people turned out for that. Several years ago, when I was doing some history on the park, I checked with the park recreation folks and asked them, well, you know, is it feasible to get 10,000 people at Williams Park? And they thought no. They thought the number was more around 4,000, but you had these tremendous turnouts. The political picture, of course, is just, you know, a whole chapter in itself there. You had some of the early governors of the state campaigning in the park there. And we had a slew of presidential-related people come through the park, the political rallies. Vice President Hubert Humphrey spoke there on one occasion. Gerald Ford, President Ford, spoke there. President Nixon spoke there before he was president. Ronald Reagan spoke there. The senior Bush was there. Carter was almost there. He did a town hall meeting at the Princess Martha Hotel across the street, and he at least looked out into the park there. There are some great stories connected with that. When Nixon was here, there's the story that the cathedral, St. Peter's, what's now St. Peter's Cathedral, used to be St. Peter's Church, was having a funeral. And all of a sudden, the bells in the bell tower began to ring, and they kept ringing, and they kept ringing. And finally, somebody went over to the church and asked, you know, could you please stop the ringing of the bells? And they said, well, I'm sorry, but we have a funeral going on. And the fellow who passed away is like 75 years old. I think that's probably apocryphal. But I did interview Senator John Saylor, our state senator here for many years ago. And he said that when Ronald Reagan was speaking in the park, the chimes over at First Methodist Church did start to go off. And he or somebody went over to the church and got them to turn them off. And so, again, these political rallies, again, turned out, you know, hundreds and thousands of people,
over the
depending
years,
upon
the
particular candidate and the particular time.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned, you know, the rally there or the party after World War I ended. The park has a number of war memorials. I mean, it starts with that beautiful monument at the entrance of the park honoring the men of St. Petersburg, both black and white, actually, which was, you know, unheard of in the South during that time, that were casualties of the Great War, World War I. And then the monuments just grew from there. I mean, how important do you think that was to the city to have something like that?
Well, it is. Again, at the end of World War I, that was perhaps the first big event, the big celebration that was to occur at the park there. That particular monument, interestingly, has the African-American soldiers who died have the designation of colored after them, which is an echo of the times that we were you know, living in. The city is, unfortunately, like a lot of cities in the South in the 20s and going on into the 70s, was heavily segregated. And it's interesting that they would actually even put that on the monument there.
Right.
But that was followed by monuments to World War II and the Korean War and the Vietnam War. And there's actually a general kind of a generic monument in the park presently honoring all who have died or served our country in the various conflicts that we've experienced over the years.
So what happened to the park, or what happens to the park when it becomes the bus hub for downtown St. Pete?
Well, that's, again, an interesting story here in the city. Some of those who were involved in it took the position that the bus was bringing folks that some didn't want to have in the park or in the downtown area. And for that reason, the bus system was relocated. The stops were relocated from the park to try to speak to that that concern. That, you know, certainly right. would not be my value. It was not, you know, my concern. My,
sure.
my feeling is that we need to embrace all of our brothers and sisters in our city and give them the, you know, where they do need some assistance and support to do everything that we can to provide that assistance and support. We do have a good network set up presently, I think, for the homeless, but there's a lot more that still needs to be done.
So, I mean, we're a city of parks. I mean, we pride ourselves. Our biggest selling point is that, you know, downtown waterfront park system and the waterfront park system that surrounds the whole city, not just downtown. Do you think more needs to be done to Williams Park? I mean, a lot has been done over the last few years, I mean, other than, of course, giving it, you know, historic designation. But what can we do to have it at the same level or seen at the same level as those parks along the waterfront?
Well, again, we spoke about designating it as a city landmark. I think that would be an important step forward to give it that dignity and that recognition. I think another, you know, we ought to scan the activity in the park in terms of entertainment and its use. Recently, probably the biggest success has been the Localtopia events. That has brought a lot of attention, a lot of people to the park, and it's made the park useful. You know, you don't want the park to be just a block sitting there. That's,
sure.
Relatively dormant. You want it to be vibrant. You want it to be alive. You want it to. You want bring John Philip Sousa back.
That's right.
And have that fantastic series of concerts there. One of the other fellows who's recognized in the park in the plaque there is William Kenman, who was a conductor of the city orchestra there for many, many years and attracted many, many people to the park. So I think, you know, those kinds of vibrant activities. That's what I would. What I would focus on in terms of actual physical changes to the park,
sure.
I don't, you know, I don't really see that. I think it's
right.
as it is. I think it's a great park, and it has been. You know, at one point, it did become the city's town square. I don't think it was ever actually officially referred to as the city's town square, but you know, that was the persona of the park.
Correct.
You know, now, like, the political events have kind of shifted to the Mahaffey. We've had our vice presidential debates there, and a lot of attention to the pier and the waterfront parks. So the Williams Park has kind of been overshadowed by those.
Well, that's air conditioning did that, I think.
Yeah, right.
Before there was air conditioning,
well,
Williams Park was the
seasonal
perfect place
activities
for that.
Are also important.
Sure.
You know, you want to match
sure, sure.
the weather with the event.
Sure.
I think it has a future. It has potential. We can do more with Williams Park.
Right,
we can have
right.
more in the way of activity there. We can give it a little more tender loving care and respect by designating it as a city landmark.
Agreed. So two stories, two quick questions before we go that I want you to touch on. First of all, and I remember her, I used to sell the Evening Independent outside the open-air post office as a little kid, and I used to watch the Bird Lady of St. Petersburg. So tell us about Esther.
Well, I came here in the 1970s, and I also saw her riding her bicycle, not just down here at the park, but in various parts of the city. And she was an environmentalist, is what she was, but she was a lot more than that. She was actually a very distinguished and well-known artist. And when she mm-hmm. first came to the city from up north, she opened an art studio here, and her paintings are revered by many in the city and other places throughout the country. But she fell in love with St. Petersburg, and she had a thing for stray cats and pigeons mm-hmm. and all kinds of wildfowl.
Yeah, she fed the squirrels,
and,
too.
The squirrels as well, right. Yeah. She really helped out the peanut industry, I think.
I think so.
So, yeah, she was a character. And at the same time, a very interesting personality, someone who, had a fantastic career and at the same time had this kind of a St. Francis value or character about her.
Gotcha. Okay, so the last one is, why is there a monument to a Polish soldier in Williams Park?
Well,
you know this answer? I hope.
My grandmother was Polish.
Okay, that's good enough for me.
The Polish, we have a lot of cultural organizations here.
Correct.
And they celebrate all kinds of ethnicities. We have the International Folk Festival. Mm-hmm. We're sister cities with Takamatsu, Japan. So we've got that whole dimension to our city. And on one occasion, that dimension reached out to the parks here. The local Polish Cultural Institute, I think is what it's called, wanted to celebrate one of their heroes, and that was Thaddeus Kościuszko, I believe it's pronounced, who was a brigadier general during the Revolutionary War and distinguished himself. He was also a humanitarian and a person of equity. He did not believe in slavery, and he took a lot of concrete actions as far as he could to try to eliminate slavery within the country early on. But he is a fantastic Polish hero as well as an American hero, and that's why he's there.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, he did help us get our independence, so that's good enough for me, right? So
yeah,
he qualifies right. for that. All right, well, so listen, thank you so much for joining us in Historically St. Pete. I mean, we're definitely going to have you back, because I know you just have boxes full of stories that you're gonna share with us.
You're going to get those boxes one of these days.
Oh, gosh, yeah. Don't tell Jesse that.
You've already got a few of them.
So stop by the museum on your next visit to the St. Pete Pier and explore the rich and unique history of the Sunshine City. Don't forget to pick up Will's books. I mentioned earlier, he's an author. We've got a few of his books on sale in our gift shop there. The museum is located on the pier. We're open 7 days a week. You can always visit historystpete.org for more details and learn about our tours and events and all kinds of good stuff. Thank you for listening, and join us next week on Historically St. Pete.